Blog Talk Radio. Reminding you that you can always find out about this show at frontierbeyondfear.com. Today, I am just so delighted to be bringing on the program someone I would consider a way shower, not only in radio, which to me is very personally important, but also in being an independent voice, which is really what radio is all about. Whether you are on the air, on the broadcast airwaves, or whether you're simply starting up a show of your own on Blog Talk Radio. And I think it's not coincidental that this month of October is actually a milestone for this show, because towards the end of this month, I reach my three-year milestone where this show has been on the air for 3 years. So, welcome everyone. Today's show, the guest today is Zohara Hieronymus. Now, Zohara is an award-winning radio broadcaster. She is also a social justice and environmental activist and a professional artist. She is what I would consider an interdisciplinary thinker and a thought leader. Her new book is The Future of Human Experience, Visionary Thinkers on the Science of Consciousness. And I actually consider her one of those thinkers as well. For almost three decades, Zohara has interviewed spiritual teachers, cutting-edge scientists, ancient wisdom keepers, laboratory-tested psychics, and other visionaries on their predictions for the future. And today, I know we're going to have a lot of ground to cover because we're going to talk about glimpses into the similarities between these forecasts and what it has to say about human consciousness. Zohara founded the Ruscombe Mansion Community Health Center in Baltimore in 1984, very into holistic health. And she hosted a regional radio program, The Zoe Show, from 1992 to 2002, and the national radio program, Future Talk, from 2002 to 2008. She currently continues to be on radio as co-host of 21st Century Radio with her husband, Robert Hieronymus. So without further delay, I am just so thrilled to bring on the air someone who I am so delighted to find is quite a way shower. Hello, Zohara. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear.
Susan, thank you so much for joining me. Gee, the Frontier Beyond Spirit is just a great lead-in for me. Spirit is everywhere. Spirit connects everything. And the past and the future are in the moment now. So the frontier is really right here, this very moment.
Yes, yes, and the entire, you are so perfect for this show, though, because the whole premise of this show is that we really are pioneers, and I am a great believer in the shift in human consciousness because I see it, I've experienced it. You know, just to tell you quickly where I'm coming from, I'm a technologist. I have a master's in computer science, and I worked in that field for many, many years. And then I'm also into spirituality, which came a bit later and evolved. So,
well, you know, they're not really separate, and I think that's also a good point. Because everything is endowed with human awareness. And consciousness, as you know from probably the people you've interviewed and all the wonderful works that exist in the world today, is something that is within the life field. You know, some people call it an L field. But consciousness is really that which is connecting everything from the smallest atom to the greatest planet. So whether it's a dog or a tree or a human or an elephant, we are all in the consciousness waveform. So that is why, for instance, in telepathy, any one of us in any species can communicate with every other species or a star at a great distance. And I think when we look at the extraterrestrial sort of phenomena that people are experiencing planet-wide, as we have forever on this planet, and we've been here for about 2 billion years at least, we see that we are not alone. And though each of us in our own bodies, in our own dramas, in our own households, in our own jobs, sometimes feel like we're isolated humans, the truth is your thoughts, my thoughts, the things we wish and pray for the world are real energies. These are real matters, and that they are coming from the immaterial realm into the material. And that's the beauty of this time period, is that we are awakening to the divine power of consciousness, to the divine power of our will, our intention, and our attention.
Yes. Yes. I appreciate how you speak of local and non-local consciousness within your work. And you raise such an important point, one that has actually come up before on this show, is that in a realm of consciousness which is expanded, we're not alone. And higher consciousness beings on other worlds would be very much aware of us. And so often people have said, well, they'd never know about us. I'm sure you've heard this theory from the technologist's viewpoint, that there's no way that an ET race would even find us on this obscure little planet. But in the realm of consciousness, that's another matter, isn't it?
Well, I think that it's foolishness and sort of gross materialism to make statements like that. You know, if you go back to the Vedic tradition, it actually speaks of the fact that there are 400,000, not one or two, 400,000 other human-like species in the universe. And I remember when NASA came out with an announcement this February of 2013, they were finally willing to say, oh, there might be billions, not two or three, billions of Earth-like planets as close as 13 light years away. So all of the damage that's been done by the materialists and those that think that, you know, the human is the greatest creation in the universe, we are just one of the species that are working to utilize our free will in a way that elevates everything. And that's really the challenge we're faced with now. You know, I've said, Susan, that when we look at paradigms, these large overarching structures that dominate time periods, we have been living in what I refer to as a death economy. We see a warlike strategy in medicine. We see a warlike strategy in the way we think about the planet. We utilize it, we use it up, we abuse it, and think that, that there's no end to our ability to do things that are so destructive. In contrast to something I have referred to as a life economy, a life economy would assert that always choose life. So we wouldn't have GMOs, we wouldn't have pesticides in agriculture, we wouldn't be radiating human beings to heal them, we would be developing products that can really stabilize and develop the immune system. A life economy says that all life has value, not just those things we pick and choose to be of value as autonomous sovereign entities. So whether it's the whales being killed by, you know, the experiments they do in the oceans, or whether it's the bees being killed because of pesticides and false hives that they're put in, these are all human choices. And so we are at a precipice, really, of deciding, will we become fully endowed humans with full awareness that everything we do and how we do everything we do matters, or we will continue to destroy this beautiful terra firma until it becomes very difficult to sustain life. And I, you, and all your listeners don't want that to happen.
Yes. You know, something I found myself reflecting upon, you used the words manifest destiny in a way that really made me think, is that when we combine that with the power of intention, what does it really mean to manifest our destiny? And I came from, just so you know, a background of conservative evangelical Christianity. And we were very much raised, and kind of entering into the first chapter of your book too, with a combination of a paradise awaiting us, heaven on earth, and also the apocalyptic end times thinking. So as I read your work and I see this concept of manifest destiny, all I can see is heaven on earth, that we can manifest heaven on earth. And I know you speak to that.
No question. I mean, when I say manifest destiny, I think the manifest destiny of humanity is to master ourselves, each one of
yes.
us, so that what we think about somebody that we meet at the grocery store or somebody that we share our lives with, that we understand every thought we have is changing the universe, changing that person. So that, for instance, if you have a healthcare provider that doesn't really believe in your ability to intuit what your body needs, that's not a good partner, because those thought forms are actual quantum bits that are interfering with your ability to open up to full faith and divinity. You know, we are all meant to, as I love the way Deepak Chopra often talks about it, and I've interviewed him for decades, is that,
yeah.
you know, we're all meant to have everything it is that we need, not everything we desire, but everything we need. And all of us get in the way of ourselves by having great doubt, whether it's doubt in our healing or doubt in our ability to have a job that's meaningful or a relationship that's full of love. And so when I speak to the manifest destiny, I think that we are at a point where once, and Larry Dalsey's just written a beautiful book called One Mind on this, and he looks through all the ancient traditions that have understood that when we come to an awareness that we really are one, all of us, every single living entity and every living thing and every immaterial thing as well, are part of the same fabric of the universe, so that our manifest destiny is to become aware of this glorified power, because what it means is that if we want to see the earth waters purified, each one of us, whatever water we're near, whether it's our tap water or whether it's an ocean body or a river at high tide, put your hands in it and say, I love you. You know, water, which homeopathy and the Bach flower remedies and other remedies have proven, holds any signature we put in it. So our bodies are mostly water, and the earth is mostly water. So we have a carrier medium that has the ability to hold any message we put in it. And I've often said, high tide prayer I wrote about years ago, when the tide is high, say I love you, and that water takes her back into the earth body, and it helps stabilize. I mean, I know, you know, materialists and people who don't believe that we are more than a dense physical body and who think we're machines don't mm-hmm. see the truth in this, and they think it's naive or adolescent, but it's been scientifically proven that we can turn machines on at a distance with our minds. We
yes.
can see anywhere and any time in history and anywhere in the universe when we focus our consciousness on it. And what that tells us is that we are biocapacitors, both a physical biocapacitor and a soul capacitor. So we have the ability to not only see the past and change it with forgiveness, we can see the future, pull it to us with love.
Yes, and something that I have found myself reflecting upon lately in my personal practice is this concept of grace, looking at it in a totally different way. I'm no longer within that paradigm that I grew up in. But when we think about the reflexive universe, that the universe is reflexive, this is something that, a concept that you present quite early, and the karmic laws surrounding that, when you speak of this forgiveness, though, you kind of speak to my heart on something I've been reflecting upon with regards to if we are on the brink and actually experiencing this quantum leap where we really are stepping into our full potential within this forgiveness of our past and our projections into the future, is there a concept in a way of grace in that this unconditional love gives us, does not make us the victims of our worst nightmares, I guess, that, you know, we can, as we step into this, people can get afraid of the power of intention, especially if you haven't heard it for years. I've had this experience sometimes, is that it's almost too much power. You know, you step into it slowly. So lots of things to think about, but I wonder if you could just reflect on this for me, because it's personally meaningful, and I know it will help the audience.
Well, you know, it was Arthur Young who first started talking, oh, this is a very ancient Hermetic tradition, and there's no tradition in which it doesn't exist, whether it's in the Chinese tradition, and you see it with their software called the I Ching, or you see it in the Mayan calendar, or you see it in astrology, or you see it in the Archaeosky matrix work of current people who are looking at patterns that exist on planet and off planet. What it's saying is, as above, so below, as within, so without. Our thoughts impact matter, and they create possibilities. And this is why what we look for is more apt to appear. So if we all think that the Earth can be restored, it is more likely the Earth will be restored. If we buy into the fear of politicians and prognosticators that are pretty much very selfish and wrapped up in kind of an old paradigm of gross materialism, we will impede the progress that the Earth itself is capable of. So what they say when we look at the future, and this comes back to your feeling and question about grace, what we rehearse in our minds is more likely to manifest. And we know this as children when we think about what we want to become, or when a surgeon rehearses an operation before they do it, or an athlete rehearses their batting before they hit the ball. All of these things are telling us that our mind is affecting matter. So we are divine beings. I completely know this to be true. We're made in the image of deity. We have the power of co-creation. Our mind is what shapes matter. So when a prognosticator looks at the future and says we may have a time period of very few people living on Earth as a result of a nuclear war, this may or may not come to pass. What they're looking at when they make their prognostication is things they can already see and patterns that already exist. So in the same way, every human being who has ever experienced something like thinking about somebody and then they call them on the phone, or having a feeling that one of their deceased loved ones is near them and then they smell their favorite perfume that that person had, these are all moments in which grace, which is the open doorway between spirit and matter. It's when our soul is in alignment with the physical world, and the physical world follows what it is our souls design, so that grace is really a natural state of being that the planet itself wants all of us to have, and that we all can have for the planet itself.
Yes, yes. It seems very consistent with your law of affinity that you talk about, that we have to remind ourselves that the universe, or multiverse more likely, is unconditionally loving and supportive, although we're free. I mean, I see that. It's an interesting dichotomy within which we live here, because we have free choice. I mean, we're not robots of the multiverse, and yet we are empowered. And I always look at this from a perspective, bringing forward these other traditions. I was taught as a child, God is omnipresent. What does that mean? And by thinking about these things, we bring each other together. We find out we're on the same page. We just don't know it. Christians who focus on end time stuff all the time, you might hear that a lot. You know, they're real focused on cataclysms. But are they really? The ones that I talk with, they're thinking about heaven on earth. They think the cataclysms are a gateway, but it's to heaven on earth. And so I begin to have hope in a way that hidden among us, even when we don't even realize it, people really are reflecting in multiple traditions on heaven on earth. The Muslim world, the Mahdi, they're focusing on a coming paradise. Even, I don't know what to think about the tumultuous part. In fact, let's enter into that a little bit. So I know your first chapter talks about that.
Yeah. What I'd like to say is that if we look at human history, and we're talking about going back billions of years, as Michael Cremo and others have shown, that there have been instruments made by great intelligence, that we've been around for a long time, not a couple million years, but about 2 billion years, if not more. And what happens is catastrophe and renewal are partners in the same way life and death is, in the same way an inhale and an exhale is. And the loss of the physical body is not the end of us. It's the loss of the physical body. So in the same way a planet has a certain time period in its own destiny, and those that occupy that planet have an obligation to protect and preserve the biosphere that they reside on, not just for themselves, but for the destiny of the planet itself, we have life. But then there are times of which there is no life, and that's a time of rest. You know, in the Jewish tradition, there's actually a time period called Shemitah, which is rest, where the land is rested every 7 years. And we're coming into every 50 years as a great jubilee when that's done. The Kabbalists say that we're in the age of Yesod. I'm a student of Kabbalah and have written two books on it, both on the prophecy of the prophets and the way in which the ancient Hebrew tabernacle is a guidebook for how each of us come into self-mastery and divine revelation in the Holy of Holies. And what it shows us is that there are ways in which, when we live, we're supposed to invigorate matter with love and unity consciousness. And our job is to elevate and to think about how we can elevate the most people, the most plant life, the most bird life, the most elephant life, the most spirit life of those beings that are helping us. But there will come a time, in the Kabbalah it says the age of Malchut, which is in about 220 or so years, we'll reach the bottom of the tree of life in our descension from spirit. And this is also in keeping with the Vedic tradition, that we used to be spirit beings without physical bodies. As we came lower and lower into the physical realm, we took on physical bodies in order to use the classroom of life for the perfection of our individual will, which then is an attribute of the soul. And as Rudolf Steiner says, we're all meant to become stars. We're not always going to be physical beings. We are units of consciousness that choose to be in a physical body for a particular purpose, which is to evolve. And so when we reach the age of Malchut, which is our feet, we will see not only women coming to power, but intuition being highly cultivated. And then humanity will start to go back up the ladder of light, and as the Vedic tradition also speaks to, we will eventually have no need of a physical body. And just our consciousness, perhaps, will ride spaceship Earth. So I think that when people get caught up in one end or other of the spectrum, they lose sight of the whole. Paradise and catastrophe go hand in hand, and there is always a time of death in anything that exists, but that doesn't mean it's non-existent. It means it's transformed into a different rate of vibration. So that yes. It's not something to be afraid of, but it's also not something to push the envelope towards. What we're meant to do is be in alignment with divine purpose, and there's a time for everything, just as they say, a time and season. And so I can appreciate why people get all caught up in the fear band, but fear is a contraction, and unconditional love is an expansion. And that's what each of us is given an opportunity to experience, to move into that ultimate, unconditional, open-ended love of life and therefore support of life.
Yes. Yes, it seems that when we overcome our fear of death as best we can, and I know you speak to immortality, and you've interviewed NDE experts, and I've had some on my show. We've both interviewed PMH Atwater. She's been on my show a few times. And to me, those visionaries who have examined that evidence and help us, they really do help us to step into our own empowerment in a way over our lives, because I think we have a tendency to, and there are those who put us in this place, to feel helpless. Like, you know, there are two ways of thinking about it. We either feel helpless or disempowered, or we have this alternative view that I've seen where I'm one with everything and what I do doesn't matter, you know, as an individual. And both areas to me carry pitfalls, because clearly your path and the path of many of these visionaries has been knowing the value of what you can do as an individual within the perspective of knowing that oneness, your immortality, and unconditional love that surrounds us all.
Well, you know, when we think about why anyone incarnates, why do we each incarnate? We each incarnate for a very particular purpose, and there is no other packet of energy like each one of us. So each person, no matter who they are, whether they're somebody who has struggled with health or they don't have a lot of money or maybe they, you know, haven't had a lot of power in their life, which our culture doesn't promote, and particularly for women who have been sort of subject to patriarchal hierarchy, both in household and culture. There was a study years ago by Dr. Randolph Burr. This was in 1986, and he took 393 heart patients, and they practiced intercessory prayer, meaning people prayed for these patients, but the patients weren't told which ones were prayed for and which ones weren't. What they found was those who had been prayed for by total strangers all over the world, not even in their location in California, they had less infection, less need for machines to support breathing, and they recovered better. You know, when Larry Dalsey first coined the term non-local mind, he was using this to talk about these things that are happening at a distance. And so I would say to anybody listening, if you ever feel you don't have power in your life, offer a prayer for someone. Offer a prayer for the animals, you say. Offer a prayer when you drive on the road and you see a dead animal. I always do this. Offer a prayer for that spirit so it can rise up. Because the truth is, as was proved by the Spindrift Institute, what we focus our attention on is changed by our attention. You know, in the scientific experiments, we now know it's something called the observer effect, that no matter what we observe, it is changed by our observation, meaning there is something happening with human intention. And from what I can gather from all the quantum physicists I've interviewed and others, is that when we focus our attention on something, our consciousness is linked to it, and it's changed by it. So no matter what you watch on TV, and try not to watch terrible news, and try not to listen to things that will discourage you from feeling that you matter, that each one of us do matter because we are matter. And there's no way around it. We each live in our community. And I say to people, you know, when I grew up, I wanted to, you know, change the world. I was going to solve world hunger. Well, I haven't. But I have solved another kind of hunger, which is that sense that people sometimes have when they're hungry for a soul awareness. And the truth is you can practice this. You know, when you drive, try to see what color the next car is coming around the corner before it gets there. And as you practice these little intuitive things, or when the phone rings, try to guess who it might be. And the more we practice cultivating our intuition, or what Ingo Swann calls bio-mind superpowers, we have the ability to affect the world in such positive ways with just where we are. So when you're sitting in your apartment or your house or you're at the beach, send out a really positive thought to the child you see crying, or to the woman you see walking with a cane, or to the person you meet in the grocery store. You will be amazed what kind of information comes back. And I used to do this for years, and then I started hearing the deceased loved ones of the people I was around. And I do animal readings for people, both dead animals and living animals. And what you discover is that everything is talking all the time in the field of life. So our power, each one of us as individual humans who are aware and conscious, can change the world by how we feel and what we think and what we do. Like if you make a meal for your family and you're angry, you are in effect poisoning them. And I know, because I had someone cook for me once who was a very angry person, and I couldn't eat her food at all. If we, however, fill it with love, be grateful for the opportunity that we're sustaining somebody else's life, they are built by that light that is in the food, because consciousness is light. And so we have the ability in your own backyard, you know, to create a little habitat for the animals that will come to your backyard. So we're very powerful beings, and our culture and the political institutions and even the university structures do nothing to teach people about their innate power.
Yes, I love how you emphasize this concept of giving. We give these prayers. We give of ourselves, and then we experience what comes back to us. I was at a conference a couple weeks ago where someone talked about how she had participated in a meditation for the earth and had felt this tremendous oneness with the earth and given love to the earth. Right afterwards, she had an encounter with a deer on the road. Mm-hmm. She didn't hit it.
Exactly.
It stopped. She said, "You don't need to come out there." And the deer didn't stop. She literally stopped her vehicle and interacted with this deer and sent it away from the road. And she felt that her participating in that meditation directly led to the encounter with the deer. And I have no doubt of it, having heard her story.
No question about that. I mean, the native traditions, the indigenous peoples worldwide know this, practice this, and have to offer this teaching that we and the earth are one. What we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. What we do to another person, we do to ourselves. What we do to an animal, we do to ourselves. So when people begin to grow into this feeling connected, and there are ways to practice, you know, there's ways to feel more connected. Just go lay down on the ground and quietly listen to your heart and feel what images come to you. You know, intuition is a great gift that we've been given that comes with every human being, and it's our right hemisphere. We're a very left hemisphere culture, and the sciences are very left hemisphere, and they tend towards self-survival, analytic separation. The intuitive,
yes,
or right hemisphere, as James Olson says, is much more expansive. Women tend to have greater intuition. We tend to be able to see the whole, and that's why women can multitask and men have a lot of trouble multitasking. But in cultures like ours that are so left hemisphere, we have to work very diligently on cultivating our intuition. And there's so many wonderful projects you can do with friends. You can set a time with a friend who lives, doesn't matter where they live, you set a particular time, and you send them a thought and of an image. You send them like, okay, I'm going to send them the image of a tree. And you ask that person at that time to just draw the sense of the image, not to name it. You know, and that's one of our big problems. The left hemisphere wants to name everything. Intuition doesn't need names. It just needs to see shapes, feel colors. And so what you can do is start to create little exercises with friends that allow you to cultivate your intuition. And if you have children, it's a wonderful thing because you naturally have a sense about your children, whether they live with you or they're mature with their own families and live 1,000 miles away. And if you sense something that your child is in need for whatever reason, even the adult child, call them and see if your hunch was right. You know, these, like, here's, you drive down the highway and you think like, oh, for whatever reason, I shouldn't get off at this exit. And then you do and you discover there's an accident, it's a traffic jam. But if you had listened to your intuition, not gotten off, and found an alternative route, you would have been okay. And so,
yes,
I think that once humanity is encouraged to cultivate their intuition, we can really move into self-healing and then healing other.
Yes, yes. I think as parents sometimes we have remarkable intuition. I had an experience when I was in college before cell phones or anything. I had to drive on a road in Colorado that was in the middle of nowhere. Well, one day I got stuck on the road and it was getting dark. And there was nothing I could do except stay in the vehicle because it really wasn't safe for me. There was no near exit and I didn't want to hitchhike. I thought, I'm just going to sleep here till daylight. My mother, many miles away, had this feeling, something is wrong, something is wrong. And, you know, sometimes we can have false feelings of that if we're in fear. But this time, she just knew, and she sent my father on the road to find me. And there he was. You know, a car drove up behind me, and I thought, uh-oh, who is this? It was my father. No cell phone, nothing. My mother's intuition alone. And that, you know, then... And to me, that was an early demonstration that probably helped set me on my path, you know, everyone. And it was amazing. And it was within their tradition, which was, you know, very traditional evangelical Christianity as well. They were open to spirit within that tradition. And in that, there's just such a message that we are closer to each other than we realize. We are all connected to spirit. No matter what,
no question about it. You know, I covered the news for a decade every day of the week, 3, sometimes 5 hours a day in different programs. And I had to cover, you know, Saddam Hussein and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and all the protests and this and that. And I remembered at the time, you know, how angry I was. And then finally I got to a point where I understood Saddam Hussein is all of us. He doesn't just exist in a vacuum. And so I would say to the audience, isn't there a time in your life you've acted like a dictator? Hasn't your anger ever been explosive that really hurt and damaged somebody else? So when we see these things in the world, whether we meet somebody tomorrow or whether it's something we read about in the news, all of this is teaching us something about ourselves, not just about other. So, for instance, the recent story about the chemical weapons in Syria. Well, the United States has one of the biggest stockpile of chemical weapons on the planet.
Yeah.
And yet here we are berating another country when, in fact, we ourselves have not gotten rid of our own stockpile. So we have something to learn about being selfish and selfless. And in Kabbalah, that's sort of what it comes down to. And all of us are a little bit of both for the most part. Ascended masters and really, you know, self-fulfilled people might be totally selfless. I'm not. Sometimes I'm selfish. Most of the time I try not to be. But I think that we can always evaluate our relationships with others and with the earth when we ask, is this action selfless or is it selfish? Is it going to benefit others or is it just for myself or my family? Does it hurt others? So the shutdown of our government, that is a total act of selfishness. It has nothing to do with governance, nothing to do with what's good for anybody except for a few congressmen and senators who feel that this is what they want for whatever reason. So, you know, I think that each one of us is challenged in the same way. Do we ever shut down other people in our life? do we ever shut down our heart? So shut down is not just a government doing something. It's representing something much bigger energetically, and I think it deals with a shut down heart. And we all have to work on opening our hearts, because the heart is 5,000 times more powerful than the mind in terms of its energy field. So any person we stand within 2 feet of, our energy field, our heart chakras are opening to one another. And that's why empathy and compassion is so powerful, because you can feel just standing next to somebody what they're going through. All you have to do is look at them and say, have a good day. Boy, you look beautiful. Whatever it is, we know that when we want to see a good quality in a child, in Kabbalah they say praise the good quality. Same way in teaching dogs without punishment. You praise the good quality, and eventually that's what the entity wants to do, because it feels so much better. The same thing with ourselves. When we want to give up a bad habit, we can't just punish ourselves for our addictions or our past choices. We have to put in something in place that's positive and praise ourselves. Oh, I ate well today. Oh, I did my exercise today. Way to go. And I think that all of these words are not just words. They're vibrations that literally are affecting not only us, but our neighbor, the people 2 miles away, the people 100 miles away, the people in China, the people off planet. So that once we come into this awareness that the question is not just who we are, but what we are. And we are light beings having a material experience simultaneously with still being souls that are eternal and divine.
Yes. You know, Zoe, something I observed on social media some time ago, I first observed it on Twitter, and then I started to participate in it as well, is people are putting out affirmations on Twitter. And when we do this, we're not always, I have found this is common to all of us who are doing this, these are reminders to me as much as to everyone else. If I get an affirmation that comes to me and then I put it out, it's telling me to pay attention, and then I just let it out there for everyone else. And sometimes it can seem, I've had people say, these people putting out affirmations on Twitter, they think they know it all, they're in perfect alignment and all that. It is not that at all. I mean, we're all dealing with our shadow self, which is what came to mind as you were talking about, who we are. But when we put out those affirmations as reminders, it creates a reality, and then it radiates. And to me, this is one of the great potentials of social media. And I see it all the time now. I see it on Facebook. People are sharing all these uplifting images with beautiful affirmations attached. And we are all uplifting each other in this way. And I think it's truly a beautiful thing. And we're using technology, and it's just one step to doing this with the mind or the heart. And actually, we're doing both. We're using technology, but we're also putting it out with the heart.
Well, technology, from my vantage point, Susan, represents inner technologies we already have. So the real cell phone are the cells of our body. The story of your father and your mother is a demonstration of a cell phone, only it was the cells of your body. When we look at fax machines, the fax is representing what we already do with our astral body. We can travel somewhere outside of our body, being awake consciously, and be seen by others who are also in a meditative state. I remember when Ingo Swann, before he passed away, he joined me numerous times, and he was the gentleman with Dean Radin and others who established the protocol for remote viewing for the military. And he was made to remote view the moon by a group who kidnapped him and hooded him and took him to an underground base, and they basically said, do this. And so he was expecting to just see some nice dust on the moon, and what he saw were humanoid-like beings, fairly naked, doing a mining operation on the moon. But the reason I'm sharing this story is that this capacity of ours to represent inner technologies through outer technologies. So the cell phone is the cells in our body and consciousness itself. The fax machine is astral travel. Teleportation, which they've now been able to accomplish with quantum bits of energy, making it disappear from one place and reappear in another, like Star Trek's Beam Me Up. These are real capacities that we already have. So it always interests me when a medium like a cell phone becomes so prevalent. The question is, does the medium itself weaken in some way our inner capacity because people then aren't challenged or trained to develop it. And this is what concerns me about robotics and nanoports and the direction we're headed, is that if everything is machine, what happens to soul? You know, soul is actually the driver of the consciousness. You know, soul is what is in the driver's seat. And if we continue to have our children, as an example, using cell phones, I remember watching a little 9-year-old boy pedaling a bike. It was beautiful. The sun was shining. What's he doing? Looking at a cell phone. So that there's a loss, actually, in a deeper kind of communication, in a sense of just being able to be silent, to hear the universe speak to you in silence. You know, children aren't comfortable with silence anymore, nor are most adults. You look at these pictures of any movie now, and everybody in the restaurant sitting at a table with their friends, but are they talking? No, they're looking at their cell phones. They're looking at something outside the feeling nature, outside the way we actually connect with people. So while it's a technology tool that is very helpful, and I love having my cell phone, the truth is we have a much greater cell phone that doesn't depend on the satellites being up, because what happens when the satellites come down or there's an electromagnetic pulse and we all lose computers and everybody loses their cell phone? Most of the younger generation don't have landlines. They haven't learned to use their intuition. They don't know how to sit quietly and be heard from around the world. And that's what concerns me about this rush to technology. And I'm sort of a neo-Luddite in that way. And I've interviewed so many of the people that are like that, because that's what concerns me. There's not a vast spiritual education going on. There's a great materialization of everything and sort of an immersion in all things technological rather than all things spiritual. And so, you know, these are the challenges we face in this 21st century. And as we move off planet, you know, what kind of humanity do we go as? What values are we actually going to share in the Intergalactic Federation? I mean, what values do we already share in our own cities or our own neighborhoods?
Yes. You know, it's funny you call yourself a neo-Luddite in a way. I felt I'm that way, too, even though I came from a technologist background. I actually worked around some of the AI people. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen, although this was years ago, but, you know, one of the technologies that comes to mind as you're speaking, Zoe, is this concept of being able to transmit a brain into a robot. And I have heard this talked about a lot lately, that, you know, this is how we will discover immortality. Well, first of all, the parallel is obvious. It's how we become souls in a human shell. But the question that comes to mind is, they just think that we're just a bunch of electrical impulses, and where is the soul? I don't really think this will work. I personally think that there's a, some would say there's a kind of arrogance to it, and in a way, I don't know if I'd go that far. It's just science wanting to be immortal and denying that spirit already provides us with this capability, but they're trying to create it themselves because of fear of death. What do you have to say to that, though, that particular technology?
We already know William Tiller, who was the chairman of, I forget what division, out of Stanford University, the material sciences, for many years. And then he became very interested in the effect of meditation in matter. And he has shown that you can imprint a card here. So a group of meditators get together and they say, turn on the left green light, or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they take that particular chip that they've meditated on, they insert it in a machine 1,000 miles away, and it works. So it turns on the left green light. So he's already shown, as have many others who have sort of moved this envelope in the power of focused attention, that we can already do this. We can imprint matter with our thought. You know, Marcel Vogel, who developed the computer program originally, not the program, but the magnetic disc, used to use his mind to just focus on these iron fillings on a plate, and he could make shapes appear. In the same way, perhaps, crop circles are appearing. We don't know, actually, the technology that's doing it, but we have this capacity ourselves. And so, you know, the concern for me about all of this is, can we come together? You know, can we as human beings really work for each other? And the beauty of the Internet is that it's made the world much closer and it's made information much more accessible. At the same time, it also pulls people out of their own life and it pulls them out of their deeper capacities you know, to hear the dog and what the dog needs, to hear the child and what the child needs, to hear themselves and what they need. You know, Warren Wagar, a wonderful gentleman who has since passed away, but he's written A Short History of the Future, and he speaks of these three periods that we're about to go into, and that one is that we're sort of in an Earth, Inc. phase right now where people are focused on the Earth, many of us, not everybody,
yes.
and that the Earth
yes.
really needs our attention, and we need to change our habits, our economy, how we use energy, where we get our energy from, et cetera. Then he says around 2044, there might be a clash between nations, like between the haves and the have-nots, and that's a really serious challenge. As some people become technologically endowed, we have people all over the planet without enough food to eat, without clean
yes.
water. You know, they don't have any kind of electricity, et cetera. They may have a cell phone, but they don't have anything else. And these haves and have not, this is really from all the prognosticators I've talked about, spiritual and military, it's the biggest concern. So they are suggesting, he suggested, so there might be this nuclear war. And when I interviewed Chet Snow and Helen Wambach, who worked with a group of meditators back in the 80s to look at the future, they talked about the 22nd century, there not being that many people, like from the end
yes.
of the 21st to the 22nd. He said then there'll be this phase called the Red Earth. It'll be the rise of the World Republic, like the great housekeeping of the Earth. As a result of this catastrophe of a nuclear winter, kind of, we'll have to come together as a world. Then he says Phase three would be we'd go back to individuation as nations. And, you know, when we think about this, this is sometimes the stages we go through when we have disease. You know,
yeah.
first we're taking care of the body. Then sometimes they do horrible things to the body, or we do horrible things to the body. And then everybody comes together to support the body. So I think our own individual lives in sickness and in health is the marriage with the earth. You know, we are wed to this earth and we are wed to this universe. And
yes.
when we experience something in ourselves, we are experiencing something that also happens in the universe. So each one of us is a little world. Each one of us has experienced what the planets experience. And so I think once we can appreciate how divine we are and how we really have the power to help our neighbor and how our thoughts when somebody bumps us off the road. You know, somebody wouldn't let me on the road the other day, and I said some words that weren't so nice. And afterwards,
yes.
I said to myself, boy, Zoe, you have some work to do.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been better to say, honey, what's your problem? Calm down. Versus, geez, why did blah, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And so I think this is the work. Each one of us has work to do of self-mastery, to come into our higher self, to find our purpose, to do everything we do with careful attention, whether it's making the bed or doing the laundry, and to manage when we have anger. Anger is a true thing. It's a fire.
Yes.
But don't speak when you're angry. Don't do things in anger. It's very destructive. It's a weapon. Sometimes it's important to be angry at things that are happening, but then it's to turn it into loving action. And I think all the great traditions of the world speak to this, because our whole body is a recording device. As I mentioned at the start, our cells hold everything, and not just our own history, but the history of our ancestors. You know, biogenealogy in terms of genetics says, if I had ancestors, which I did, who were running from the Cossacks, I still have some of that fear-based running from the Cossacks in my bloodline, and it affects me. So the work each one of us does changes the genetic line, not just through some sort of genetic intervention, but through our thoughts. So we can literally heal those traditions of fear, aggression, war, by in our own lives trying to create peace within ourselves, within our life, in how we relate to others.
Yes. Yes, I appreciate that it is so much about our own awareness. And I will tell you, though, I'm a work in progress, as I know everyone, all of us are. And I'm
for
coming
sure.
to some of these things pretty cold. I have to tell you that. I mean, I don't know tons about holistic health. I don't know, you know, I didn't come out of those traditions. I was living in the Midwest for years and years, you know, eating things that weren't good for me. But suddenly, Zoe, and I know this is happening to other people who are listening, I have become aware. For example, if I overeat or I eat something that I just know is bad, and for some reason, you know, there are reasons why we eat the wrong things, we can be influenced in it, whatever. Afterwards, I have started to reflect, how do you really feel? I actually asked myself that question,
mm-hmm.
and I feel awful. I don't feel
right.
good. Same
well,
thing with the
grow.
Anger. The anger.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I express anger, I've started to think to myself, how does, you know, I can feel how I don't feel good. It has a real effect. And
for sure.
The more I become conscious of this, I mean, it's an obvious thing. If I eat this or I do this, it makes me feel unwell. But the more I'm aware, the more I change my behavior, because then it becomes a reminder. It becomes,
right,
okay,
exactly.
I remember, you know, I'm looking at a meal and I'm thinking, you know what, I'm just not going to eat that. You know, sometimes people will put things in front of me and I'm just like, you know what, I'm just not going to eat that. I'm not going to eat it because I know how I'm going to feel. And I am adjusting my behavior step by step, and I know we can all do this. It's just about awareness, and that's what you seem to speak to, and I appreciate
and then following
that.
You know, a lot of us will have a hunch or we'll have a feeling we won't do it because maybe we're at a family dinner and everybody else is
mm-hmm.
eating that thing, and not to makes a big problem, but sometimes you have to decide, you know, what's more important? Well, my longevity is important, and the quality of my life is important. I want to share an interesting story. The Spindrift Institute was founded by a father and a son, Christian Scientists, the Klingbeils, and they're no longer living. But they wanted to study the effect of prayer. So they did thousands of experiments on mung beans and rye and fruit flies and this and that, and they found that, for instance, if the mung beans were kept dry and the meditator said they want it to be more moist, it didn't have a great effect. But when the meditator said, may divine right order be restored, the mung beans took in more moisture. They did this with a lot of different things, and what they were able to prove is that there's a difference between particle prayer, which is asserting your will, and wave prayer, which is thy will. So, for instance, if we know somebody is ill and we're praying for them and they have heart disease, you don't necessarily want to say, may the left ventricle be healed. You might want to say, may divine right order be restored in Aunt Martha's body. And the effect will be much greater than the prayer of, may the left ventricle be healed. So this is true for the earth. Rather than making it a very particular or particle prayer, you make it a love wave prayer of thy will, which is divine right order. So they did an experiment on a triticale seed, which is a GMO, a genetically modified organism, which we all know to be poisonous to the earth, to humans, to animals, and to our whole future. It's really death exponentially the 10,000th time. They had the meditators try to change the triticale seed one way or the other. It did not respond to anything. And what they proved, that it's not in the life stream. There's nothing about it that supports life. And that's an example at the worst degree of the death economy, of trying to control the seed bank so seeds can't grow themselves, trying to have us all eat foods that we now know may even be contributing to autism and other degenerative illness and certainly digestive illness. So I was glad to see, and it's an example of hope. I sign all these petitions that come to me via email, and there was a policy in the budget that was going to protect Monsanto called the Monsanto Protection Act, which meant they wouldn't have to prove it's safe, they wouldn't have to label it, they could get away with hell, basically, on Earth. Well, fortunately, there were enough of us that sent emails to the Senate, and they pulled it out of the budget bill. So there is hope, and that's the point. Each one of us each day can do a little bit. We don't. Each one of us is not here to perfect the world. We're here to perfect ourselves and to contribute to the world in a really beneficial way. So don't. And I have to remind myself this. I'm not saying I've mastered all this. I haven't. I'm also a work in progress. I have to remind myself the hope is that there's millions of us. There are millions of awake people that want what's good for the earth, and they want what's good for future generations. And they're not going to stand for any of this nonsense anymore, because it's that day and age of avarice and separation and war and destruction is over. So each of us in our own little communities can go to our grocery store and ask for organically grown food. Each one of us can ask them to label any GMO product. And when you buy foods for your children or your grandchildren, try to make sure you buy non-GMO foods, because what we already know from the scientific tests is that it leads to disease. So that's just one example of something that's very prevalent right now in the current economy and in our lives that we can change by the choices we make and how we shop. So go to the organic grocer. You know, spend a little more money. Budget for it, because what you put in your body, you also put into the earth. So I think that, bottom line, we're all spirit beings, and we're here for a purpose, and our purpose is to learn to do good and to serve each other and to serve the world. And that's really it. We're here to serve each other.
Yes, yes. Well, Zoe, this show has gone by so fast. I swear I could do several shows with you. There's just, we've hardly scratched the surface of all the different areas you cover. And I do want to highly encourage people to pick up your book, The Future of Human Experience, because to me, not only you share your own thoughts within this book. This is what's so inspiring, is that when you talk to people, you have these wonderful experts coming on, but it's a time of sharing, and mm-hmm. it's a mutual time. I find you, I'm so glad to discover you, Zoe, because you're
well,
a wave
you.
Shower to me, and in some ways an affirmation, because I've tended to go about interviews as a discussion, and some people have told me, you have to ask more questions, you know, you're putting too much of yourself into your show. And I'm like, well, you know, my show is my show. This is the way it is. And so,
well, you know, what I learned
me,
after being a radio broadcaster for so many decades, it was I've become a good listener. Because when
yes.
I listened, I was able to really ask the right questions. And the book, The Future of Human Experience, is an integration of about 80 of my thousands of guests to really
yes.
look at the body of the world, the mind of the world, and the soul of the world through the human experience. And so the most important things are like saving the bees, you know, making sure we have organic food, that we have air to breathe that's healthy, that the water is clean. And I look at it with solutions. Every problem that I've posed through the lens of science, there is a solution to it. And again, it's just get quiet and listen to your own self. Folks, you are wise beings. And when
yes.
you have a hunch about something, pay attention to it. It might save your life or someone else's.
Yes, yes. So very important. And, you know, we are empowered. I am really very inspired by your work. And we're heading into just the final minutes. And I want to make sure people know where to find you, give you an opportunity right at the end to talk
Thank
about
you.
That, anything.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You can go to my website, www.zohara, Z-O-H-A-R-A, online.com. That's zoharaonline.com. The book is called The Future of Human Experience, Visionary Thinkers on the Science of Consciousness. It has people like Dr. Mehmet Oz and Raymond Moody and Dr. Larry Dalsey, Michael Cremo, Gabe Bradshaw, many others. And you'll find, I think, something of interest for all of you, whether it's near-death experience, traveling off-planet, saving the Earth, all good things we can do together. www.zohara, Z-O-H-A-R-A, online.com. And Susan, thank you so much for having me today.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege to have you on this show, and I think we've all learned a great deal from it, Zoe, so thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. You have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to end just with a few show notes here in the final 2 minutes. Our next show is with Barbara Hanclough. She's going to talk about astrology and the rising of Kundalini. And that is on Friday, October 4th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. So I'm really looking forward to that show because Barbara, she only does some radio. She doesn't do a lot. And so it'll be a really nice opportunity to talk with a real way shower in the world. And then just looking ahead, on Monday, October 7th at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, we have Dr. Alan G. Hunter coming back. And he's going to talk about the 6 archetypes of love. So this is a follow-up discussion to his talking about the archetypes that he has defined within literature. And Alan is a professor of literature and very knowledgeable of how it speaks to us. So those are things coming up. If you want to learn more about this show, go to frontierbeyondfear.com. That will also include links to today's guest, Zohara. Her work is also highlighted there and will be out there for a while. I am currently enhancing the site. I really want to get a listing of all the guests that we've had so that people are really accessible so that you can listen to the various guests. And let me just say, I am very appreciative of the community around this show. I also, we didn't get to talk about this today, but Zohara's book talks about the nature of time. And something I'm always aware of is there are people listening to this show, the vast majority of you, in the future. And I recognize your presence here in the energy of this moment, no matter when you're listening to this show, because time isn't linear. Awareness can go across time. So thank you again, everyone, for being here. And I hope you were just as inspired as I was today. There are just so many things to think about. Thank you.
Thank you.